All right, welcome back for another summer break re-release episode. This is Tux with a listener favorite this time around. You may remember we did an Instagram contest where we asked you guys to nominate your favorite stories that we'd done throughout the season. We put them up to a vote, and the Japanese detention center's story was the winner. Your favorite story that I have told throughout this entire season. I think this is a really great, really important story to revisit. It was a really challenging story for me to research and to tell just because it's such a big story and there's so many pieces to it that I wanted to really make sure that I was kind of doing everything right and doing the story justice. But obviously, no one has time to talk about every little moving part. And there were a lot of things that I maybe will come back and revisit it at some point. But one of the people who nominated this story was Rachel from the Hashtag History Podcast. So we actually reached out to her and we asked her if she could say a few words about why she nominated this story. Hashtag History has actually done their own episode on Japanese internment. So if you want to learn more, I've listened to that episode. They do a phenomenal job with it too, and they actually have some details that I miss. So if you want to learn more about the story after you're done listening to our version of it, go check out Hashtag Histories. All right, here is Rachel.
Hi, this is Rachel from the podcast Hashtag History, and I am so excited that for Beyond Reproach's summer re-release of previous episodes, they are bringing back one of my all-time favorite episodes that they have ever done. Tux's coverage of the Japanese detention camps, as with every single topic that Tux and Stephanie cover, was so eye-opening and enlightening for me. On our podcast on Hashtag History, we also have covered the Japanese detention camps, and so I obviously spent an extensive amount of time conducting research into the topic, and even still, I learned new information from Tux's coverage of the same event. I so appreciate the thorough research and the compassion and heart that the hosts of Beyond Reproach always put into every single topic, and this particular topic is no exception. I cannot recommend this episode more, and I am so thankful that Tux and Stephanie are bringing it back for their summer re-release. Even though I love this episode and have already listened to it at least 3 times, I will be listening to it again.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you everyone who voted for this story on Instagram. Give it a listen, and we'll see you again in a couple weeks with another listener favorite, Summer Break re-release. Okay, so Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941.
Oh no.
Just before 8 a.m., hundreds of Japanese fighter planes flew over the Pearl Harbor Naval Base in Hawaii and dropped a whole fuck ton of bombs and killed a whole bunch of people. Today, the day that this episode will air, is the 79th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Wow. That was sort of coincidental. I did plan to have this be my like December episode, but I didn't realize it was going to come out on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. So happy accident, I guess. So during this attack, more than 2,400 Americans were killed, including civilians, and another 1,000 people were injured. Almost 20 naval vessels were destroyed, including 8 battleships and over 300 planes. The very next day, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt asked Congress to declare war against Japan. So obviously, if you're American, you learned about Pearl Harbor in school. You learned about that. It's sort of like the beginning of America getting involved with World War II. But did you ever learn why Japan attacked us? I don't remember ever learning that. Or like if there was a reason that Japan attacked. Do you know?
No.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't remember ever hearing any, like that there even needed to be a reason.
Oh, wait. They hated us for our freedom?
Yes. Freedom ain't free, Stephanie.
I got it right, you guys.
Freedom costs $1.05.
So affordable.
So basically what was happening was that in the 1930s, Japan was acting real aggro towards China, mostly because they wanted to corner their import market. They wanted to take over China's import market.
I did know a little bit about that. Okay. I know that they fought for like hundreds of years with the Japanese,
yeah,
over control over their islands.
Well, so in the 1937, Japan actually declared war on China. And for whatever reason, America was like, wait a minute, this is our business for some reason. And we decided to put our foot down. Like, hey, Japan, you're not allowed to declare war on China. And so we imposed a series of trade embargoes and economic sanctions against Japan in the hopes that if they couldn't get essential supplies, like especially oil, that they would have to back out of their war against China. Because, for some reason, that's our business.
Well, we were trading with the Chinese.
Yeah,
and
okay.
We wanted to preserve that, I'm sure.
Yeah. But so all this really did, it didn't stop Japan from warring with China. It just pissed Japan off. And Pearl Harbor was an easy target.
Yeah.
So that's basically the whole.
The Japanese were like, you can catch these hands
too. Yeah, exactly. Fuck all y'all. So the day after the attack, FDR addressed Congress.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us.
Okay. So people were big mad, obviously. I mean, this was the first time that we had been attacked. It wasn't even American soil because Hawaii was a U.S. territory, but it was still a U.S. naval base, and people were very upset. I mean, as you can imagine, I would be, you know, probably too. But so before this happened, Americans wanted to stay out of World War II. We had lost so many lives during World War I. We saw it mostly as a European war. We didn't want to get involved. We didn't want to lose lives fighting Europe's war. So we were like, fuck that. Let's stay out of it. Basically, told FDR specifically, like, don't get us involved in this shit. We're not having it. But then when Pearl Harbor was attacked, everyone was like, oh, okay, let's kill everyone. Fuck this noise. The details of Pearl Harbor are, you know, looking into it a lot more interesting than they thought they were. Because I feel like schools and media and everything that you hear kind of tends to focus on Europe when they talk about World War II.
Yeah.
Not really the Japanese front. So I never really even thought much about it. It was, you know, it's always Hitler that you hear about. So learning about it was really interesting, and World War II has always fascinated me. However, I'm not going to be talking about World War II today. What I'm going to be talking about is one of the worst violations of American civil rights in the 20th century.
Oh.
And that would be what happened to Japanese Americans living on U.S. soil after this attack. So I would like to propose a toast to refusing to learn from our mistakes and to just keep repeating them over and over and over again. Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
Mistakes, what's that?
Yeah, it's good. I do like it, but it still tastes like cough syrup a little bit.
Yeah, the first sip was interesting. But now I'm like, okay,
I think as it warms up also, it sort of
tastes more medicinal. Tastes a little,
no, I'm finding less. Oh, okay. Actually, it's sort of like the sharpness is kind of cooling off.
Okay, so before we entered the war, we had eye holes.
Yes.
We could see what was going on in the rest of the world. Even though we wanted to stay out of the war, we knew that there was some fuckery happening in Europe and in Japan. So the FBI had started putting together this list of German, Italian, and Japanese aliens living on American soil who they thought could potentially maybe be suspects of being enemy agents.
Okay.
These people, the FBI knew who they were, where they were, what they were doing, kept them under heavy surveillance. And because of this, The government knew that the percentage of Japanese Americans who were potential threat to the United States was very low. They knew this already, mm-hmm. but that did not stop us from targeting Japanese Americans pretty much immediately after bombs were dropped on Pearl Harbor.
Instead of the Germans and the Italians that were in greater quantities.
Exactly. Yes.
I wonder why. I guess you'll tell us.
Yes. Hint, hint. Racism.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
Because Italian and German people look white, so they're fine. So within hours of the attack, the FBI had rounded up and arrested almost 1,300 Japanese community and religious leaders with absolutely zero evidence against them because they wanted to, quote, protect the West Coast.
Mm.
About a month after the bombing in January of 1942, a naval intelligence officer in LA reported that Japanese Americans were perceived as a threat almost entirely because of their physical characteristics. He wrote that less than 3% of them might be inclined toward sabotage or spying, and that the Navy and the FBI already knew who most of those 3% individuals were, and were already keeping an eye on them. So that wasn't really what the government wanted to hear, because we wanted an excuse to target Japanese people.
Yeah.
So Congress commissioned a report. Roosevelt commissioned two secret investigations. The U.S. Justice Department, the FBI, and the military all looked into it on their own. And every single one of these investigations and reports and committees, every single one of them confirmed Japanese Americans were not a threat to national security. One of the reports that Roosevelt commissioned stated, "There will be no wholehearted response from the Japanese in the United States to support the Japanese war effort." This report also emphasized the loyalty of Japanese Americans to the U.S., and when the report was forwarded to Roosevelt, it was sent along with a one-page memo that said, "For the most part, the local Japanese are loyal to the United States, or, at worst, hope that, by remaining quiet, they can avoid concentration camps or irresponsible mobs." Yes.
Okay. So concentration camps were already in the consciousness.
Mm-hmm. They saw the writing on the wall. They knew exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah. It's like they have eye holes.
Yeah, they were right to worry because the government was already considering, quote, relocating Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we knew they posed no threat to national security.
But it makes it look like we're doing something.
Yeah.
You know, because we're tough.
Yeah.
Et cetera.
Yeah, I guess people just felt uneasy seeing a Japanese-looking person walking the streets.
Yeah.
I mean, they felt the same about the Chinese.
Yeah. Especially on the West Coast, yeah.
And it opens up spaces for white people, right? I mean, this is like white supremacy. So if you, if you take Japanese people's jobs away from them, white people can take those jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah. And their homes and businesses too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
At this point, Congress really wanted to like figure out if there was still a way to make this happen. So there was a congressional committee hearing, and representatives of the Justice Department brought up logistical, constitutional, and ethical objections to this proposed policy of relocation. But unfortunately, most government officials shared the position of General John DeWitt, the Army general in command of the West Coast, who said, "A Jap's a Jap. They are a dangerous element, whether loyal or not." How are they dangerous if they're loyal? What does that mean?
Yeah.
So everybody else was like, yeah, this guy knows. They're dangerous even if they're not.
It makes sense if you don't think
exactly.
about it.
Exactly, yeah. So in February, FDR signed Executive Order 9066, giving General DeWitt the power to relocate anyone who could be deemed as a threat to the West Coast, laying the foundation for immigrants from Japan and their children who are U.S. citizens by birth to be sent to, quote, relocation centers further inland. The language in Order 9066 did not specify any ethnic group. It was just saying anyone who could be deemed a threat, but that left things really open-ended, and General DeWitt used his new power to specifically target Japanese Americans and no one else.
Yeah, that's kind of a thing that this country has done foundationally. Like, the first time I think enslaved people are mentioned was in the 13th Amendment. Like, they just leave it really vague, and it's just like, wink, wink, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also that we don't have to talk about them.
Yeah,
because we all know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
We don't have to name it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because who else would we be talking about? We're not going to round up
Germans or Italians. So first, General DeWitt announced curfews that only applied to Japanese Americans, especially in urban centers around the West Coast. And then he went and asked...
Wait, who is this again?
General John DeWitt. He basically was like the military commander in charge of the entire West Coast.
Okay, and I'm sure you're probably going to get to like how this is legal.
I mean, it's not. But,
oh, okay.
But
what a stupid question.
FDR signed this executive order giving him the power to do it.
Oh, okay. So yeah. it's like a war power.
It's legal if we say it's legal.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Legal until proven
otherwise.
Illegal. Right. Yeah. So then in certain areas, General DeWitt asked Japanese Americans to voluntarily evacuate from the coast and move further inland. He just wanted to get them away from urban centers and especially places where there were military bases and manufacturing centers. And about 7% of the Japanese population in these areas did move. But of course, when they moved further inland, they weren't welcome there either. Nobody wanted them around.
Yeah. At least on the coast, they had community.
Yeah, exactly.
There's safety in numbers.
Yeah. Because of racism, people tended to live in segregated neighborhoods of just other Japanese people. So
they couldn't just buy a home anywhere.
No, exactly. And they tried and it didn't really work.
Yeah.
And then because they were moving to other places, 10 state governors surrounding the West Coast got together and went to the government and was like, hey, don't let these people just move wherever they want. We want them locked up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
I wonder, too, if, and this is maybe just my urban prejudice showing, but if they were being relocated out of more desirable areas of the city, you know, in terms of real estate. So they were leaving, like, expensive locations and being forced into less desirable rural areas where, because then we could, you know, they could
take their land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's entirely, like, possible. I didn't specifically see that in any of my research, but... That we've done that plenty of times already. So
sure have.
Yeah. So on general, excuse me. Jeez, why can't I speak today? I just need more gin, apparently.
Loosen my jaw gums.
So on March 29th, General DeWitt issued public proclamation number 4, which started the whole process of forced evacuation and detention of Japanese Americans living on the West Coast. And the War Relocation Authority was formed specifically to help organize these efforts. And they put a man named Milton Eisenhower from the Department of Agriculture in charge of doing this. He lasted about 3 months before he resigned in protest because he saw it as incarcerating innocent civilians and citizens.
Yeah.
So there were like a handful of people that still had a functioning head. But not many.
It's like arresting people for like thought crimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, not even thought crimes. It was for having the wrong face.
Look about them. Yeah.
This was obviously a clear violation of constitutional rights.
Duh.
But almost 112,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and forced into these hastily built, they were called assembly centers. Nearly 70,000 of these people were American citizens. There were 17,000 children under 10 and several thousand elderly people. And it was not just America doing this. America started it, but after we started doing it, Canada did it too. They relocated about 21,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And Mexico actually deported about 2,000 people, mostly to South America, some of them to the U.S.
Wait.
Yes.
Wait, you're deporting people to South America? Oh, that explains a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There were huge Japanese expat communities in Brazil, in Argentina, from trading.
Wow.
But,
I didn't know that
yeah,
they
like
were
São
deported.
Paulo was a huge Japanese population, Japanese Brazilian population. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Sexy.
Yeah.
So back here in the U.S., there were never any charges of disloyalty or sabotage or espionage or anything like that ever filed against any single one of these people. None of them.
Because they were all rounded up for no reason already.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's like, what can you even do?
Yeah, we're doing it preemptively. So you can't do the spying against us. Ha ha, we got you.
The best defense is a strong offense.
Yeah. So
I play basketball in middle school, so I know.
You know all about this. So there was no way for them to challenge or appeal these rulings against their loss of personal liberty or loss of personal property. These people were given only a few days to evacuate their homes. They were only allowed to bring what they could carry with them to the relocation centers. And in the couple of days that they had notice, they had to either sell off everything that they owned or find tenants who could rent out and care for their property while they were gone.
Oh, no.
But of course, they didn't know how long they were going to be gone for. So how do you find somebody that's like, hey, can you rent out my property but not send me the money because I'm going to be in this relocation camp?
Right. It's not like they had direct deposit back then too. Yeah. Like, where do you send the rent?
Yeah. And like, I don't know how long I'm going to be gone. It could be it could be a month. It could be a year. Mm. It could be 10 years. Who the fuck knows?
Wow.
That's part of the thing that makes me suspicious from a real estate standpoint, where they just wanted to seize these houses alongside the, I mean, because that's how like white supremacy operates.
Well, also the bulk of Japanese people living in California at this time were farmers.
Mm.
So I actually took this out of my outline because it's just, for time, but there was a huge food shortage after this happened during the war because we lost entire giant 112,000 people that were farmers before are just gone. And then California isn't producing even half the food that they were before.
Hmm.
But then white farmers started moving in and taking over the farms.
Yeah. We're seeing that this year, right? When the tightened immigration rules under the current administration and how there are like food shortages in the supply chain because we can't find people. Because unlike in the 40s, white people don't want to do these jobs now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we don't have anybody picking the tomatoes.
Well, like I said, to never learning from our mistakes or just repeating them over and over.
Yay.
yay.
I'll drink to that.
So if these Japanese Americans did not make arrangements for either selling off or having somebody take care of their property, it was just lost.
Wow.
They lost their farms, their homes, their businesses, and most of their belongings. Lost forever just because they couldn't take them with them. And there was no way to keep them safe while they were gone. So most people started trying to sell things off. And when their white neighbors found out what was going on, they would come and be like, oh, hey, here's like absolutely nothing for all your stuff.
Yeah.
I will give, you know, they were offering $1 for a refrigerator.
Ugh.
Cars that cost $700 or more, they would offer $100 or less.
Wow.
And they had like days to sell all this stuff off or just lose it. So they had to take what they could take. And like Stephanie said already, just in case you don't know or weren't aware, this never happened to German Americans, Italian Americans during the war.
Nope.
We did not do this to anyone that looked white during World War II. But Japanese Americans were an easy target because of the way they looked. So they were all sent to these assembly centers, quote unquote,
centers. They could find all the German people, sorry to interrupt, if they wanted to.
They
just didn't want to.
Especially after World War I. A lot of German people had made really big efforts to change their names and move out of German communities and sort of assimilate in a big way after World War I because we saw Germany as an enemy even then.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a big push to change, like in cities where there were huge German populations, people left those areas and moved to sort of like, you know, they could have still rounded them up if they really tried.
Yeah.
But people, they weren't seen as a threat. Okay. Because they had already done all these efforts to assimilate. And, you know, a lot of German people had also been here for many, many generations. Whereas Japanese people, a lot of them were first generation, second generation, maybe third generation.
Mm. Yeah. And to be fair, there were a lot of anti-Italian efforts, but that was all sort of funneled through like papacy. It was through anti-Catholicism. Right. That was because Italians are... There was a viewpoint that Italians were more loyal to the Pope than they would be to the United States president.
Yeah.
And it was up until like Kennedy, I think, that
they
were still worrying about that. And now Catholics rule the Supreme Court. So.
Yeah. So these people were sent to these assembly centers. And I keep saying these people. It sounds so gross that I say these people. But I'm talking about Japanese Americans.
Yeah.
I feel like otherwise I'm just going to say Japanese Americans over and over. They're Japanese Americans, though, because we're not talking about, like, Japanese nationals or I don't know.
I mean, they're Americans.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so there shouldn't be a distinction.
Yeah.
There really shouldn't be. So these Americans were sent to these assembly centers. And they were thrown up as quickly as the government possibly could put them together. And for that reason, most of them were located on racetracks or fairgrounds that had big barns or stables for livestock. And they were forced to just sleep in like cow sheds or horse stalls because they didn't have time to build them housing yet. A lot of times they got there and they're like, this is where you're sleeping. And there's still cow shit on the floor or wow. horse shit all over the place. And they're like, there you go. There's your bed for a couple months until we figure something else out.
Yeah. But be loyal to us.
Yeah, exactly. And they were.
Yeah.
They had been up until this moment, you know? And even still afterwards. These places were never meant for human habitation, but that's where they were forced to live. Eventually, the government did start to put up some sort of like military-style barracks in the parking lots just outside these places for additional housing because they weren't big enough for the number of people that were being housed there. But it became clear even then that they still needed a much more permanent solution.
Was it just the people on the West Coast, or were they pulling, it was really, like, New Yorkers too?
It was just mostly coastal states, Washington, Oregon, and California. Most of it was all in California that this happened.
Okay.
But it was all coastal. West Coast.
West Coast,
yes. Yeah. Yeah, this didn't happen in New York.
Okay.
Or at least not that came up in my research. It's possible that a few people might have been targeted by their neighbors or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were doing that big time. All the white people were like, hey, there's a Japanese person. Go get him.
Yeah, probably a Korean person.
Seriously, yeah. So Portland, Oregon. In Portland, Oregon, 3,000 people were housed in the livestock pavilion of an expo center.
Oh, no.
And the Santa Anita Assembly Center northeast of L.A. was basically a small city. There were 18,000 people interred in this one assembly center, and 8,500 of them were living in stables. Their food shortages were incredibly common.
What do they do with the horses?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of these places, because they're like, seasonal, it's like livestock pavilions for expo centers, they were temporary.
It they're just
like,
hotels for horses?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's some. It's a place for them to go just for an event, and then they leave.
Right.
But there was also substandard sanitation. Most of the toilets in these places consisted of pits dug into the ground with boards over them for you to stand on. So finally, in May, the WRA was able to complete building 10 permanent relocation centers further east in these sort of far-off remote locations. Some of them were in California, Arizona, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and Arkansas.
Whoa.
Arkansas seems so far from the West Coast, but one of them was in Arkansas. And the WRA started transferring all these people from the assembly centers by train to the relocation centers. And they were put on this train and just sent and discovered that these camps were in these like really horrible remote locations that in like really inhospitable climates. And it was not, you know.
So we knew that the Germans were doing this to the Jewish people at this time, right? Like putting them on trains.
By this time, yeah, we would have known that by 42, right?
And yet.
Yeah, maybe not the scale. And we might not, I mean, it depends who we is.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah.
But the government
probably
knew at least
if they cared
part of what was going on. I don't think by 42 it was fully realized how bad it was or what was happening in the camps.
Yeah, we didn't know in 42 the extent of it.
Yeah.
But clearly
we knew about the relocation camp because Jews were being...
Yeah, in that Japanese people, you said, were worried about being put in camps.
Yeah, exactly.
So clearly there was some knowledge there.
Yeah, and two of these relocation centers, the two in Arizona... were on Indian reservations.
I was just thinking because the trains were, I'm sure, horrible, but they had trains, unlike what we did to Native people, is just making them walk.
Yeah.
You know?
Taking all their fertile land and just making them walk.
Yeah.
They were put on these Indian reservations despite protests from the tribal councils, but the government Bureau of Indian Affairs just overruled the tribal councils and was like, nope, that's where they're going to go.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
Ugh.
That's also wild, too, because it gets them out of U.S. It gets them off of U.S. soil.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So all of those questions about like what you can do to a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil come up.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very good point.
So like the black sites in the Iraq War.
Wow. So the government called them relocation centers or evacuation centers. To make it kind of sound euphemistically benign, we're just simply relocating them for their own safety.
Yes.
We're sending them farther away from the West Coast to somewhere else, and they're just going to live and everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, that's what we told the Cherokee.
Yeah. But in reality, these were much more like prison camps. They had guard towers, searchlights, barbed wire, armed guards, and roll call. And in
fact, roll call.
A handful of people were shot and killed trying to escape. Some people were even shot for getting too close to the perimeter of the camp. Just, they're like, you're going to try to escape. I know it.
Yeah. Wow.
Today, the common term for these camps is internment camps. Most people, I myself called them internment camps until I started researching this and realized that legally, only alien nationals and civilian subjects of an enemy power can be interred by a government.
Okay, so it's a concentration camp?
Well, yeah. So yeah. Civil rights activists, a lot of people are trying to call them incarceration camps because they were so, you know, the prison-like conditions and the fact that they were treated as if they were guilty of espionage or sabotage. But again, because no one was ever actually tried for any crimes, I think detention centers or concentration camps is probably the most accurate way you can refer to them.
Yeah, anything that the U.S. government tells me to call it is like, I'm suspicious.
No. Yeah.
I'm like, I don't like this word. Yeah. If you like this word, then I'm against it.
Yeah.
Welcome to Hashtag History. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah. And if you're a history nerd
or even a history hater,
this is the podcast for you.
Even if history was your least favorite subject in school, we can guarantee you will like this podcast because we talk about all the things that your history textbooks did not.
Things like how the Bonnie Prince Charles and his Jacobite uprising was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, or how the Pharaoh Akhenaten was so disliked by Egyptians that they literally purged his name from nearly all of their records and pretended like he had never existed.
And we do all of this while drinking and rating a custom-made cocktail specific to that week's topic.
So grab a drink, take a seat, and hang out with us each week as we learn all about history's greatest stories of controversy,
conspiracy,
and corruption.
So there actually were internment centers as well on U.S. soil. Thousands of Japanese nationals were sent to internment centers. And unlike the relocation centers, these were completely separate, run by a completely different government office. They were set up very differently. And because the people living in the internment camps were considered prisoners of war, they were afforded specific rights to health care and food quantity and food quality under the Geneva Convention. So in practice, this actually meant that the people, innocent people living in the relocation centers were living in much worse conditions than the people in the internment centers who had rights under the Geneva Convention. Housing in these, I guess, detention centers, concentration camps, housing consisted of military barracks. Usually four or five families were forced to live together in one building because they were sort of just like open, long, sort not super narrow, but long and narrow.
Yeah, bunk beds.
Completely open. Yeah, and four or five families would be living together with almost no privacy between where each family lived. They were forced to eat communally, which was a big deal for these families to be sort of forced together, and like the whole family structure was lost.
Yeah.
A 1943 WRA report said that the housing consisted of tar paper covered barracks of simple frame construction without plumbing or cooking facilities of any kind. Most of them had wood stoves for heat, but there was no insulation against cold weather and there was no ventilation for hot weather. Gradually over the years, because they lived in these houses or barracks for years, over the years, some insulation was added little by little. Some like lightweight partitions were put up for privacy. But even by the end, these were still horrible, horrific places to live. Bathrooms, showers, and laundry facilities were all located outside the barracks and were shared by larger groups. And in such close quarters, diseases like typhoid, dysentery, and smallpox ran rampant through the camps.
Of course.
On-site medical centers were understaffed and undersupplied. Food poisoning was also really common. After the camps finally closed, when survivors of these camps were asked what was the hardest part of living in these relocation centers for so long, what
I
was
like everything.
The number one answer was living conditions.
Of course.
It was.
So how long were they there?
Most people lived there about 3 years because it started in 42. The war ended in 45.
It's a long time.
Yeah. The last camp didn't actually close until March of 46. Wow. But it was just like they kind of were like slowly releasing people. I don't know, even though the war was already over. So each of these camps basically was set up like its own little town. They had schools, a post office, places for worship, places of work.
Work.
they did have the ability to work. Most of the work was farming because these places did have farmland and places to keep livestock.
Were they paid for their work?
Not at first. Most people worked a 44-hour work week full-time. And no, they weren't paid in the beginning. Eventually they were, but...
Were the children working?
I don't know. I think it was mostly just like you didn't have to work unless you wanted to. And people didn't have anything to do. So they wanted to work. And most of the work that they were doing, there was some manufacturing jobs helping like build things for the war effort. But most of the work that they were doing was farming. So they were growing their own food. By, I think it was 43 or 44, the camps produced 85% of their own food. So they were mostly self-sufficient. And most of them even had livestock, chickens, cows. One of them even ran its own dairy.
Okay.
So I think people wanted to work because they were bored. They didn't have anything else to do. And it helped them run the camps better. They got better food were growing it themselves. Life in the camp eventually did kind of take on these sort of familiar routines of socializing with your neighbors, going to school, going to work. Mm-hmm. It was still horrific.
Of course.
Traumatic and damaging to a point that like lasted generations.
Yeah, definitely. Trauma is they're now doing research to see that it's like genetic.
Yeah.
Inherent.
In second generation people, like you can inherit trauma.
Yeah.
It like fucks with your genome. It's that bad.
I mean, having shared restrooms and shared showers with absolutely no privacy is so dehumanizing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so fucked up.
Yeah.
And then the part about having these families being forced to live together in the same building with communal eating areas and taking people's jobs and their livelihoods away from them, basically just... It eroded Japanese identity because there was a real like patriarchal family structure in place. And then all of a sudden overnight, their friends are gone.
Yeah.
Their neighbors are gone. They don't have jobs.
Everything they've worked for is gone. And they're just in prison because they're Japanese.
It's crazy. And during the war, when there were labor shortages because so many men were off fighting, some of the camps released some of their detainees to go work as migrant farm workers to help cover some of the labor shortages. And in 1943 and 1944, some of the men from the camps were even allowed to go fight in the military.
Oh, lucky them.
Yeah, I know. They formed this Japanese-American combat unit called the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and it ended up becoming the most highly decorated unit of World War II.
I'm not shocked.
You
have to work twice as hard. They're like, maybe if we fight and die for this country, then they'll treat us like people. It's like, no, there were black people in the American Revolution.
Yeah.
So it's a no for us, dog. Oh, that's so sad.
So obviously this is unconstitutional, doesn't even cover it.
No,
it's so fucked up. But most Americans at the time thought that it was necessary and justifiable because we were in war and we needed to protect ourselves.
Yeah.
But the people that were living in the camps still believed the lies that we tell ourselves about this country and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So three of the Japanese American citizens living in the camps, three people took their cases to the Supreme Court, challenged the constitutionality of relocation. Two of the three lost their cases. But fortunately, a small handful of people did still have functioning brains.
Stockholm syndrome is real.
Yeah. Right?
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, that explains every minority group in this country.
Yeah.
It's like you have to believe.
I mean, to make it here, yeah.
Yeah.
So Mitsui Endo is the daughter of Japanese immigrants. They were living in Sacramento before they were relocated. And she filed a habeas corpus petition against the U.S. government. And the government was actually worried that she was going to win her case. So they offered her freedom. And they said, you can leave. You can go live a normal life. It's fine. And she was like, no, fuck y'all.
Yeah, no.
She's like, I'm staying here until everyone can leave.
Yeah.
Because I want my case to go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And it did. And she won.
Mm-hmm.
In Endo versus the United States.
I mean, they knew when they tried to buy her off.
Right?
Like,
absolutely.
Like, oh, no. You can come out.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
No, we're not doing that. So in Endo versus the United States, it was discovered that the WRA had no authority to do what they were doing. Justice Murphy of the Supreme Court expressed the following opinion. I am of the view that detention in relocation centers of persons of Japanese ancestry, regardless of loyalty, is not only unauthorized by Congress or the executive, but is another example of the unconstitutional resort to racism inherent in the entire evacuation program. Big facts.
Yeah.
Like,
searching for the lie and coming up empty.
Where did you find this tea to spill? We thought we put it in a closet. You weren't supposed to find it. The court was going to announce their ruling, but this was 45. By the time her case made it to the Supreme Court, the war was already wrapping up. We knew things were looking up for us.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court actually decided they were going to let Roosevelt look like the good guy, and they told him, announce that you're going to release people from the camps because we're about to announce our ruling. So he announced to the American people that he was going to start closing these camps. And the very next day, the Supreme Court announced its ruling that...
trash.
Yeah. So, like I said, the last of the camps finally closed in March of 1946. And no Japanese Americans were ever convicted of sabotage or any serious spying charges during the entire war. Not a single one.
Not shocked.
112,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Just minding their business, living their lives.
Yeah. And despite government pledges to preserve their property while they were gone, the few who had tried to save their property, rent it out to someone else or whatever, they left the camps and found that their homes had been sold, stolen, or seized for non-payment of taxes.
Right.
No. Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
That is...
It's so fucked up.
They knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. As much as $370 million in income and property were lost during this time, and that's in 1945 dollars.
Mm. Oh.
$370 million in 1945 dollars. So these people, they left the camps and went home to find out they had no jobs, no belongings, and no homes to go home to. And when they wanted to try and find new jobs and new homes, they were just met by racism and xenophobia.
Yeah.
White people were not having a bunch of Japanese people show up and start living in these neighborhoods again.
Yeah.
One man who lived in the camps said that the experience was both humiliating and disorienting. We came out of these camps with a sense of shame and guilt of having been considered betrayers of our country.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
So the war's over. In theory, people are supposed to be able to go back to normal, go back to their own lives. But of course, how do you do that when you have nothing?
Yeah.
So in 1948, the government organized the Japanese American Evacuations Claims Act that was supposed to compensate for property loss. But unfortunately, many of the records were lost or incomplete. Surprise, surprise.
Oops.
So it was hard. It was so difficult for the U.S. government to establish or verify these claims against them.
Hmm.
It's a real challenge, and we can't quite make it. Some of the Japanese farmers did eventually get their property back or receive some form of compensation in exchange for losing their property, but most of them did not. Most of them never got anything. Between 1948 and 1963, $148 million in claims were filed, and only $37 million of them were ever settled. So, like, over $100 million worth of these claims were just like, we can't figure it out, sorry. You'll be fine. So, and then in 1976, we're jumping ahead, finally.
Is this when they secure the bag?
Well, so, Gerald Ford officially repealed Order 9066 in 1976.
Gerald Ford, I haven't looked that deeply into him, but it seemed like
he was doing some good things about the right. Yeah.
And, I mean, as much as you can be about the right when you're... you know, the chief executive of this place.
Yeah. Yeah, he was trying to do the right thing.
Yeah. He's like the only administration that wasn't fucking with Cuba.
Wow. Really? The only one?
The only one in, I think, 60 plus years. Yeah.
Damn.
They had no illegal, like, weird wiretapping. They weren't trying to kill him. Zero.
Because why? Why waste all that time and money? Countless administrations have tried and failed, so why keep wasting money?
All that money we could have spent on, like, schools. Mm-hmm. Like,
Ford might have been a little paranoid about wiretapping, too.
Was he?
In terms of how he got his job, after Nixon.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. And also, he didn't have a whole lot of time.
Yeah, that's true.
So then in 1980, despite the fact that this was the Reagan years, we started doing some good things in the 80s.
What?
Yeah. Congress.
My story is going to prove that wrong.
I was about to say, are you sure?
There were a handful of decent things happening in the 80s. But for the most part, as this show has already proved, the 80s were high time for fuckery. Yeah. We were doing all the wrong things in the 80s. But Congress did organize a commission to investigate the legacy of the camps in 1980.
Okay.
After extensive interviews and personal testimony from victims, the commission issued its final report, which called the incarceration a grave injustice motivated by racial prejudice, war hysteria, and the failure of political leadership.
I love the racial prejudice instead of racism.
Yeah, racial prejudice.
Yeah.
It sounds so benign.
It does.
And failure of leadership.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to, like, leadership was very successful. Yeah. It was just trying to do incredibly racist, fucked up things.
Yeah, they didn't fail at anything.
They didn't fail. They were very successful.
They succeeded at being racist.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then in 1988, Congress actually issued a formal apology to Japanese Americans, and they passed the Civil Liberties Act, which awarded $20,000 each to any Japanese American who had lived in the camps as reparations for their treatment. But at this point, it was 1988, almost half of the people living in the camps had already died. Mm-hmm. And they set this whole program up specifically not to pay out any money to any to the descendants of the people who had survived
that
the camps.
That is such trash. I did not know about that.
Yes.
Yeah. I thought they got their money for real.
Like only people who had lived through it were ever allowed to collect any money because the government specifically did this on like with a very specific goal in mind because they didn't want to set up a framework or a precedent for reparations.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
They said, quote, reparations for the descendants of slaves, indigenous people forced onto reservations, Mexicans who lost land, or any other historical victims of racism.
Mm-hmm.
So they did not want to set a precedent for anyone else to be like, but wait,
you
owe me some shit too.
Yeah, especially because it was such a short period of time. Still, it was awful.
I mean, 3 years is a long fucking time, but in the grand scheme of things, it's a blip.
Hundreds of years. Like, how do you
it's a tiny blip.
Natives
for... exactly. Exactly.
It's like, that's a...
The theft of the entire... country.
Also
$20,000. $20,000. Thank literally. You. Absolutely I dick.
Mean, in 80s money even.
I'm sorry I ran over your kid with my Bentley. Here's $5.
Yeah.
Does that make it better?
That's like four Armani suits.
Yeah.
Wow. I did not know about this. I did know that the Japanese got reparations, but I thought it was generational and I didn't think it was only $20,000.
$20,000.
You
person.
Can't buy a Kia for that. Like, fuck out of here.
I mean, in 1980, you might have been able to, but
still,
like...
these people lost their homes, their jobs, their lives.
$20,000 in 1988.
I wonder if that was taxed.
I know.
Oh.
Dude, I bet it was, right? I bet it was taxed.
I'm sure it was.
In some way. That's wild.
My heart hurt. I didn't even think about the tax.
Yeah.
Why give them anything?
Seriously.
Yeah. Why give them anything? Yeah.
So that you can say that you did the right thing.
Right.
Oh.
And settle the matter.
My blood pressure is through the roof right now.
Yeah. There was a huge, like, sort of Japanese-American civil rights movement to make this happen, too.
Of course.
I cut a lot of the details of this out.
That's the only way you force them to do the right thing.
Yeah.
I mean, right, air quotes around right thing.
But basically, $20,000 is like, this is enough to get those people to shut up.
Yeah. Is it, though?
I mean, we don't hear about it today.
Yeah.
So I hope that this... story can serve as
I'm disgusting.
Yeah, I mean it's fucked up. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. And people don't know about it. Actually, the reason
Tim
that I told
this out that part about me saying they secured the bag, they most certainly did not.
No, the bag only had it was a bag full of rusty nickels.
magic beads.
Seriously. Oh no.
It's funny. It's not funny, but it's coincidental that you. This was your story a couple months ago. I wrote a story about George Nakashima, who is this... He's sort of the preeminent modernist furniture designer and sculptor with wood. He's like a genius, absolute genius with wood. Amazing, amazing things. He famously made this one sort of coffee table that you would recognize if you saw it. It has this like... Anyways, George Nakashima was held in the camps.
Oh, wow.
And... yeah. There was an exhibit of some of the work that he had done at the Shofuso house in Philadelphia. It's amazing. They have a toy box that he makes these like extraordinarily beautiful furniture pieces and sculptures that sort of honor like the grain of wood. Mm-hmm. They're very organic looking. But in this exhibition, they have a toy chest that he made in the camps for his daughter. And it's made out of planks of wood from houses that had fallen and like found nails. And it's the most, it's just this extraordinary object. So it might still be up through this fall. If any of you listeners are in Philadelphia, you can go see it.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
It's really beautiful. And his sort of fellow designers that he had worked with outside of the country got him out of the camp and relocated him to Hope, Pennsylvania, I think is the name of the town that's not far outside of Philadelphia, where Nakashima very famously started this studio and made all of the highly covetable modernist furniture that now sells for more money than the Japanese Americans received for their reparations.
Yeah.
You could maybe buy a chair for $20,000. Wow.
George Takei actually was in the camps as well, and he wrote a musical about it in 2012, I think. Mm-hmm. But so I hope that this story serves as sort of a reminder of the dangerous and combustible nature of public fear, ethnic scapegoating, and xenophobia.
Yeah, we're seeing that at the border.
Yeah. And I hinted at this with my toast at the top of the story, but the living conditions at the ICE detention centers on our borders are significantly worse than the living conditions that people experienced in these relocation centers. Mm. Yeah. Significantly worse and much more inhumane.
Yeah.
But the cages are so clean.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really disgusting, scary things happening.
Yeah.
Like, apparently they're putting some migrants in, like, hotels and inns that have vacancies. Mm, but then, like, no one's able to get to the floor to see, like, the children. They're holding them. And there are, like, armed guards on the floors. Yeah. Like, that you can't get... I think it was the Hampton Inn.
It was the Hampton Inn. Because they just recently said that they've terminated the contracts with ICE.
It's scary.
But only because they got caught.
That's like, so what are you doing to these kids?
Yeah.
That, like, you don't want anyone to see. Like, a social worker tried to go in and, like, see about the conditions, and he was, like, pushed into an elevator.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, so that's the end of my story.
Yeah. Thank you for that story. I did not know about... I mean, I knew about it, but I didn't know the details.
Yeah, same. I knew that it happened,
but... even more horrified.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, time for more cockatiels.
Yes.
Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.